solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
And so that was the theory of disruption as we applied it to products and services. But the discovery then I had is that personal disruption is how you take all these ideas and make them meaningful to you. You start at the bottom of a ladder, you climb to the top, and then you jump to the bottom of a new ladder, like the children's game, Snakes and Ladders. The big difference with personal disruption is that you are Netflix and your Blockbuster, your Uber and cabs, you're the silly little thing and you take over the world. You're the disruptor and the incumbent because you are disrupting you.
Welcome to the 60-Second Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and I work with leaders as an executive coach, sounding board, or as a transition advisor as they navigate the journeys. The two questions I try and help leaders with are where to go and how to grow. I find that these two questions are quite parallel to the two questions businesses need to ask in the context of their business strategy, where to play and how to win. In this podcast series, we feature conversations from leaders from different walks of life on three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. The guest this time is Whitney Johnson. She's the CEO of WLJ Advisors and one of the 50 leading business thinkers in the world, as named by Thinkers 50. She's an expert on helping high-growth organizations develop high-growth individuals. Whitney is an award-winning author, world-class keynote speaker, frequent lecturer for Harvard Business School's Corporate Learning, and an executive coach and an advisor to CEOs. In this conversation, we dive into her book, Disrupt Yourself, which is inspired by the thinking of late Clay Christensen and is thinking around disruptive innovation. The only difference is that when it comes to personal disruption, we are the disruptor and we are the disrupted. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Whitney Johnson. Whitney, thanks so much for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Deepak.
And congratulations on the new launch of the book, Disrupt Yourself. How's the book doing?
It's doing really well. We are so excited. It was so wonderful when Harvard Business Press came to us and said, we want to, you know, republish under our imprimatur, and they've already are going into a second printing, which is what you want to hear when you publish a book. So it's doing really well. Thank you for asking.
Lovely. And I'd like to dig into the book during the conversation, Whitney, but maybe before we go to the book, I'd love to maybe spend a few minutes on your journey. So talk to us about how you got here, the path you've taken, and more specifically, what got me curious was you take Clay Christensen's approach to studying disruption in a business context, but you apply it in a personal career context. So talk to us about how you got here and how you stumbled upon on studying this parallel, if you will.
Happy to. All right. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of my personal story and you'll see how this all leads into to this idea of disruptive innovation applied to businesses now to people. So I grew up in the United States and in California, which is what is now Silicon Valley. Very typical in many ways. You know, I studied music in college and then once I graduated from college, I moved to New York with my husband. And yes, I got married in college. And so we get to New York and I can still feel the absolute terror that I felt as we were driving across one of the bridges, the George Washington Bridge, for those of you who are familiar with Manhattan, and just so scared. I'd never been in a very, very big city. And I remember, for the first week, I wouldn't actually go anywhere by myself, but we needed to eat food because my husband's in school and he has a very small stipend for graduate school. And so I have to leave our 19th floor apartment and go out and get a job. because I had never set foot in a business course because I studied music. I had zero connections in New York. I had obviously very little confidence, and clearly I'm a female. My first job was working as a secretary to a stockbroker. So I go to work every day and there is this bullpen of young stockbrokers. They're all male, aspiring masters of the universe. Pressure to open accounts is intense. So they say things like, throw down your pom-poms and get in the game. At first, I'm a little offended because I was a cheerleader in high school. I said I had a very typical background. I did, you know, high school, cheerleader, you know, all sort of the things that girls do or did at that point in time. But as I heard them say this, throw down your pom-poms over and over again, I realized, okay, I'm going to be working at least 5 years. Why would I make X when 10X is a possibility? And I'm pretty sure I'm just as smart as these guys. It was time for me to throw down my pom-poms. I would not have known to call it this then, but that was really the beginning of me disrupting myself. I started taking business courses at night, accounting, finance, economics. I then had a boss who believed in me, who was willing to give me the opportunity to grow, which if you know financial services, that does not happen. You don't cross the divide from being an executive assistant to an investment banking analyst. I then had to take a step back from banking into equity research. We had two children, which is a very big disruption for all the parents who are listening. And then I left Wall Street to become an entrepreneur, connected with Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School, and co-founded a disruptive innovation fund. And now several more disruptions later, I've become an author and a researcher, and then codified this framework that we're going to talk about today that I teach to organizations around the world. But that was the beginning of, and that's really my message in this book, is to disrupt yourself over and over and over again. Now, your question is, how did I hit on this idea of disruption also applies to people?
Or even how did you get to Clay Christensen from equity research, right?
Oh, great question. Okay. All right. So here's what happened. I'm an equity research analyst. I'm covering emerging markets, telecom and media. And many of your listeners are in India, so you'll really relate to this. This is now late 90s, and I am covering a company called America Mobile and a company called Telmex. Very, very big wireless providers in Latin America. America Mobile is a wireless provider in Latin America. Telmex is the landline. And I come across this book called The Innovator's Dilemma. And this book was really intriguing to me because at that time, I had just started covering America Mobile. One of the things I discovered is that every single quarter they were beating my estimates. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, why do they keep beating my estimates? And then I read The Innovator's Dilemma, which basically says this silly little thing can take over the world. And I realized, oh, that's what's happening, is that people are saying, you know what? I don't care that the sound quality of wireless isn't very good. What I care about is the fact that I have a phone now because it's much less expensive than a landline. I care that I'm able to talk to whoever I want, wherever I want. So I am perfectly happy to not have this very good sound quality. And so people started buying these phones. They were much less expensive. They could talk anywhere. They buy these phones. And so quarter after quarter after quarter, wireless is upending wireline. And when I got this book, The Innovator's Dilemma, I'm like, this explains it. This is what is going on. Wireless is disrupting wireline. So that was my first introduction to his ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And before we dive into the framework, then you set up the Innovators Institute. Could you talk about that for a minute before we dive into the S-curve?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened then is I'm reading this book, and I now have this experience of I understand what's going on in wireless. But at one point, I had gone to my boss and I'd said, you know, I feel like I've been doing this for about 8 years. It's time for me to do something new. And he said to me, well, we like you right where you are, which happens the world over. And he wanted me to just keep doing what I had been doing. But at this point, it's now about 2004. And I've read The Innovator's Dilemma, as I just shared, and had this kernel of an idea that this theory isn't just about products It's about people. And so within about a year, I basically disrupted myself. I left Wall Street. And at this point, we're now living in Boston. I make my way to Clayton Christensen, work with him on a number of nonprofit projects. But when he wants to start a fund using this framework of disruption, he says to me, and he did this with his son as well, you know, will you help us launch this fund that applies the framework or theory of disruption to investing? So that's how we connected.
Fascinating. Fascinating. And let's dive into the sort of the heart of the book, Whitney. You talk about the S-curve that Clayton Christensen talks about in the context of innovation. And you talk about how disruptive innovations take hold in the world of business and apply that to personal disruption. So maybe to level set, talk to us about the S-curve and why don't you set up the overall framework in terms of the parallels you see?
Yeah, absolutely. So, one of the first big ahas that I had that I've mentioned is that as I was reading The Innovator's Dilemma, that this theory of disruption, it's not just about products, it's about people. This silly little thing that can take over the world. So let me explain that and then we'll go to the S curve. So what do we mean when we say disruptive innovation? It's that, so you think about, how the telephone disrupted the telegraph, the automobile disrupted the horse and buggy. More recently, we've seen Netflix disrupt Blockbuster and Uber is disrupting taxis. And so it's that thing, there's this framework where the disruptor gains a foothold at the low end of the market. Initially, its products are inferior, its position is weak. You think about Netflix in the 1990s, Blockbuster could have crushed them like a cockroach, but they didn't. And market leaders rarely bother because it is that silly little thing. It's nothing to worry about. It's no big deal. So let's go after bigger and faster and better. And then the bad news, of course, is that the disruptor, the new entrant, is also motivated by bigger, faster, better, and so it goes. And so that was the theory of disruption as we applied it to products and services. But the discovery then I had is that personal disruption is how you take all these ideas and make them meaningful to you. You start at the bottom of a ladder, you climb to the top, and then you jump to the bottom of a new ladder, like the children's game, Snakes and Ladders. The big difference with personal disruption is that you are Netflix and your Blockbuster, your Uber and cabs. You're the silly little thing and you take over the world. You're the disruptor and the incumbent because you are disrupting you. So that's personal disruption. Now, you asked me about the S curve. What do I mean there? So the second big aha that we had, or I had, is that we're applying this S curve to investing. And this was popularized by E.M. Rogers in 1962 to help explain the diffusion of innovations, how quickly an innovation would be adopted. And we were using it in our investing to figure out how quickly something that we were looking at would penetrate the market. Well, the second big aha now is, you know, disruption's not just about products, it's about people. The second big aha was that this S curve, where you start at the bottom, then you get into the sweet spot. Once you hit the knee of the curve, then you get to the top of the curve and the saturation, that applies to people. It applies to how we learn. It applies to how we grow. And so that was a second big insight. And I can explain it if you want to, but I'll stop there for just a second to see if you have questions.
No, absolutely. I think maybe if you could lay out what's on the x-axis and y-axis just for us to visualize the curve and talk about the various portions of the curve, and then we could maybe go into some of the specifics.
Yeah. Okay. So what I want you to do is I want you to picture the y-axis is success and the x-axis is time. And let's start by explaining y-axis, x-axis, if you think about disruption. So when you decide to disrupt yourself, you're effectively, let's call it your number 18 on the y-axis of success, let's say. And at this point in time, your trajectory in your career, in your life, in your business is over one, up one. So picture this big piece of graph paper. You're over one, up one, over one, up one. When you decide to disrupt yourself, mathematically, what's going on is you're saying, okay, I'm at 18, But I believe that if I'm willing to move down this y-axis of success, however I'm defining it, let's say I'm at 18, I'm willing to move down to 15 because I believe that if I move down to 15, my trajectory will no longer be over one, up one. It will be over one, up three, over one, up three. So I'm stepping back or I'm stepping down to slingshot forward. So that's what that idea of personal disruption looks like for you as you're trying to visualize it mathematically. Now, the question is now that you've disrupted yourself and you're on this brand new trajectory, you've got this new learning curve. Well, how do you grow along that new learning curve? How do you grow along that S curve of learning? Well, what we know about the math, and I want you to all picture this, is at the bottom of that S, there's this bottom of the S, the base of that S. We know from the math that growth will appear to be slow. So you're moving that along, takes a lot of time for what appears to be very little happening. So it's going to appear slow. You might feel very overwhelmed. It can feel like a slog. And so there's this place from an emotional standpoint, you're like, it looks like nothing's happening, but that's what it's supposed to look like at the low end of that S curve because the exponential growth is not yet apparent. But then as you put in that effort and you put in that time, you move from that flat part to the knee of the curve into that sleek, steep back of the S. And this is the period of hypergrowth. This is where for you as an individual, whereas at the low end, it took a lot of time to seem like anything was happening. Now in a little time, a lot happens and you know enough, but not too much. It's hard, but not too hard. It's easy, but not too easy. You are exhilarated. All of your neurons are firing. You feel like this is exactly where you're supposed to be. This is the sweet spot of the S curve. And then as we keep going up that S, you now get to the top of that S and it flattens back out. And this is a period where growth starts to slow. And because you're no longer learning at that rapid pace that you were on the low and sweet spot of the curve, you start to feel underwhelmed and you start to get bored. And so this is that place where what seems like a plateau, what seems like the top of the world can actually become a precipice. And so you've learned and now you know that from a neurochemical or neuroscience perspective, now that you've learned, it's time to leap. And when you follow this framework of personal disruption, you're basically learning and leaping and repeating. So that's the S curve of learning framework as it applies to you, an individual.
And maybe just to understand this better, Whitney, is there an example you want to share to understand the three or four phases you spoke about? Could you embellish it with a specific story or an example?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see, what story do I want to tell around this? Okay, so let me tell a story that I think really illustrates this idea of what happens with the S curve. So imagine that you are a vice president, you're one of 25 at a company of 6,000 people. And that is what the top of the S curve looked like for Dan Shapiro. Dan Shapiro had joined LinkedIn in 2008. He had studied math and statistics in college. He'd then gone to business school. He went to work at Bain in consulting. And then 2008, he arrives at LinkedIn and he starts in operations. But by 2008, he's basically at the top of that S curve in operations. And I think that often happens when we start a new role is even though ideally we would start at the low end of that S curve, we end up in the sweet spot because people don't quite know where to put us and they want us as competent as possible. Mm-hmm. But by 2010, Dan's at the top of that S curve because typically you'd expect 3 to 4 years, but it takes him 2 years. So he jumps to the bottom of a new S curve inside of LinkedIn and he moves into sales. So he's at the low end of that S curve, but by 2013, he's now at the top of that S curve in sales. When he started, they had about $10 million in revenue. Now they have $1 billion. So yes, it's a rocket ship. He had about 8 reports. Now he has 1,000 reports. And so he's at the top of this S curve and he goes and he has this conversation with his boss's boss, the CEO, and says, hey, you know, look what happened. Like, let's do a victory lap. I'm at the top of the curve. I would love to be a a tech CEO myself someday. And his boss says to him, well, if that's your dream of being a tech CEO, you're actually on the wrong curve. He didn't say that, but basically you're in the wrong job. You can't get there from here. Tech CEOs, they build product, you're in sales. So now Dan's looking at this saying, I'm at the top of the S curve. What do I do? Well, a lot of people in this situation would have said, well, I'm going to jump to a new S curve. It's not going to be here. I've hit the top, kind of like what I did when I left Wall Street. I jumped to a new S curve somewhere else. But Dan didn't. He comes back after about 2 months. He's deliberating, very frustrated, of course. Then he says, okay, let's build great products. And his boss is looking at him thinking, what? You've got 1,000 reports. You've got a $1 billion line of business. And you want to jump from the top of that S curve to the bottom of the S curve where you've got no direct reports. You've got 4 engineers you're working with and no guarantees for the future. And based on the data, we know, and LinkedIn has a lot of data, people don't move from product to sales. But Dan made that jump. He jumped. He jumped to the bottom of that S curve. Now, there were parts that he was terrible at because he was inexperienced. He was on the launch point of the curve, which is exactly what you want. You want people to be inexperienced because they ask questions like, why do you do it like this? But there were parts he was amazing at. He had all this ability, all this experience that allowed him to contribute in a really unusual and meaningful way. 6 years later, he gets up to the top of that S curve in product, and then he jumped again to the bottom of a new curve, now is responsible for all of sales globally. So that's what it can look like. There's a risk when you do it. There was a risk for Dan. There was a risk for Dan's family because they were like, you know, he probably went home and he said, honey, I shrunk my role today. That had to have been a really tough conversation. There was a risk for his boss and his boss's boss. But that step back, that willingness to become a silly little thing, to move down the y-axis of success to a lower axis became a slingshot, not only for Dan, but also for LinkedIn. So that's what it can look like for you inside of an organization.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. One thing that occurs to me here based on what Whitney says is that we all need to think of ourselves as a balance sheet and not just as a P&L. To Whitney's point, sometimes we just focus on our cash flows and expect it to grow upwards year on year. But sometimes taking a step back and building our assets could temporarily put us back, but could create a new stream of cash flows. Linda Grattan, the author of 100 Year Life, speaks about how we should be cognizant of the intangible assets we are building as we go through our journey.
Well, you know, as you know, in the book, we talked about 3 types of intangible assets. We talked about productive assets, vitality assets, and transformation assets. And I think really, you know, in your 40s, the productive assets become really important because you need to keep on learning. You need to keep on building new skills. You need to be saying to yourself and to the labor market, you know, I'm still somebody who's got a lot to offer from now until the age of 70. So that's really crucial. But also, of course, transformational assets. And those are, as we said earlier, you know, transformational assets are a lot to do with your network.
And as we think about building transformational assets, going up a new S-curve definitely is one way to look at it. As you would appreciate, it takes quite a bit of effort to put this podcast together. Our listeners have come back and said that they really value the fact that we connect the dots across the various speakers, and that requires effort. If you're deriving value, do take a moment to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. It'll help listeners discover this show from the clutter that's out there. And it'll also make it easier for us to raise the bar on the kind of people we try to get on the show. Now, let's get back to Whitney Johnson. And let's talk about that, Whitney. Let's talk about the, let's say, the bottom of a new S-curve. And in a way, when I work with leaders, I say they're either asking a where to go question or a how to grow question. And picking the next S-curve is a bit like a where to go question, right? Which mountain do you climb? And how should leaders think about identifying the next S-curve for themselves, either internally or externally, right? I'd love your take on what are some of the mistakes you see leaders make here. And the reason I ask this is, to your point earlier, the slope of the S-curve at the bottom is actually quite slow, or quite low, rather. It takes a while for you to get feedback on how well you're doing. So you don't know if it's the right S-curve, but it's still yet to take off, or the wrong S-curve. So how should we think about just picking the right S-curve?
Oh, there's a lot of really good questions in there. Okay. First of all, I love that. Where to go or how do you grow? Fantastic. Okay. So let me answer that question in two parts. So let's start with, first of all, the first accelerant of personal disruption. So there's seven accelerants of personal disruption. And the very first one is to take the right risks. And that actually answers both of your questions. It answers both the where to go and the how do you grow question. And so what do I mean when I say take the right kinds of risk? Well, there are two kinds of risk I think about. There's competitive risk and there's market risk. And competitive risk is that you know you've scoped out the market, you've got these projections, you know there's an opportunity, you just have to figure out if you can compete and win. And with market risk is you don't know if there's a market, but if there is a market, if there is an opportunity, then there's no competition. And we know from disruption theory that when you're willing to take on market versus competitive risk, the odds of success are 6 times higher. So you want to, when you're thinking about your business, you do that all the time as a leader. Like, should we, you know, we're going to take on competitive risk if we think we can win, but we also are looking for opportunities to take on market risk because we know the odds of success are going to be higher. So that's something that then for you as a leader and as you're managing your career, you want to think about, well, what does that look like for me in my career? Most of you listening to this podcast have probably taken on a lot of competitive risk and you've competed and won. But if you want to win even more, and you'll find that those instances where you have won even more, you're taking on market risk. You're finding ways to play where no one else is playing. And let me give you an example from my own career that I think will really illustrate this. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on Wall Street and there is a merger. Our bank's acquired and my boss gets fired. And I think they probably would have fired me too, except that I had really strong reviews and I happened to be pregnant at the time. And so you don't tend to fire people that are pregnant with strong reviews. So they're like, what do we do with her? Well, they shove me into equity research, which is basically like going from flying a fighter jet to a cargo plane. So remember that y-axis of success? I moved down that y-axis of success from the 18 to the 15. And once I got there to equity research, it turns out they already had an equity analyst covering the sector that I was supposed to cover, which was cement and construction. So what do I do? How do I take on market risk? How do I play where no one else is playing? Turns out, there were a number of media companies going public at the time. There was no analyst to cover them. So rather than knocking on a cement door that was closed, I built my own media door. And because I built a new door, because I played where no one else is playing and there was a market there, instead of it taking me years to get ranked and get awards as an analyst, I was able to get to the top of the leaderboard in just 1 year. Now, here's the thing for us to really consider as you're thinking about your own career is that when I found a place for me to play where no one else was playing, I also found a place for my organization to play. When you build your own door, you're building a door for your company, for your organization, because the fundamental unit of growth, the fundamental unit of change in any organization is the individual. So that's how you think about this idea of where to go, but also how to grow is you take the right risks and the odds of success are always going to be higher when you're willing to play where no one else is playing as much as possible. One other thing I'll say on that, because I think this is really encapsulate this idea. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I came across a quote from one of my mentors, Bob Proctor, and here's what he said, "Amateurs compete, professionals create." Isn't that good? Amateurs compete, professionals create. So that's what I really want you to think about is first accelerant of personal disruption, you take the right risks, you create rather than you compete. And so that's the first accelerant of personal disruption.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here again. For a moment, if we pause and think about the world we are living in, and the explosion in the number of possibilities around us, given the exponential growth of technologies and the way things are being connected, I do think it requires a different approach to the way we think about climbing multiple S-curves in our journey. Tarun Khanna of Harvard Business School was earlier on the podcast and he shares an interesting insight.
You know, maybe you lived in the time of the sage Valmiki in India, and a certain set of known things. And as a truly wise man, or wise woman, as the case might be, you might expect to know, I don't know, 0.1% of things that were known to humankind. I'm making this up, of course.
Sure, I hear you.
And today, with the exponential increase in knowledge, you may know, you know, a vanishingly small number. Maybe it's 0.00001% of things. So the question is, how do you ensure that you have a unique capability to contribute, given this bewildering explosion of knowledge and the tiniest sliver of which you are a master or mistress, right? And I think that puts a real premium on being able to communicate what it is that you have to the rest of the world so that you can facilitate the emergence of combinations with your own skill set. So that's the way I think about it. That specialization isn't going to go away, and it's a pretty straightforward and direct corollary of the fact that you have to specialize to survive because things are developing too fast to do otherwise. Otherwise, you will condemn yourself to mediocrity. But if you over-specialize, then your ability to communicate with people with different specialties is now at a premium so that you can raise the odds that people productively combine with you and find it useful to hang out with you and do things with you so that collectively you will into being new possibilities.
Got it. No, I love the way you frame it as an opportunity to facilitate a combination of new possibilities based on what gives you energy and your unique uniqueness.
Yeah, and if I may say, I think this really is a mindset issue. You know, confronted with this sort of situation, I think a lot of people would find it, they may not confess to it, but would find it intimidating. And it is intimidating at one level, but the thing that it helps me to remember is that everybody's in the same boat. Hmm. We're all trying to do the same thing. It's not like that the explosion of knowledge is uniquely disadvantaging your uniqueness, if I may say it that way. And so there's really no reason, there's no upside to being bewildered or befuddled or lost. You just simply get on with it.
Got it.
And I think that mindset is actually quite motivating, and so stop worrying about the fact that you know almost nothing.
If I take my personal context, as a search consultant at Egon Zehnder, I felt senior leaders had access to the best of bankers, consultants, marketing agencies, lawyers, and so on for their business needs, and didn't have anybody for their personal journey. I felt, just like strategy consultants need to help companies with where to play, I felt there was an opportunity to be a trusted sounding board with leaders in helping them solving where to go. Often this is not just a work question and involves understanding the life context, their aspiration, the family situation, and so on. This also requires a piece around assessing the market opportunities. So post Egon Zehnder, I've tried to build a web of trusted relationships with the rest of the search firms so that I can be a quote-unquote sell-side banker to the leader or a sports agent representing the athlete. I feel there's an opportunity at the intersection of the poaching world and the coaching world, and that's the piece I'm trying to build in my journey over the last few years. It's still early days, but I can say that it's been a fulfilling journey to craft something on my own terms to address a market opportunity than being one more player in an established market and participate in a shootout or a fashion parade where people have to make a choice for a coach. It's still evolving and work in progress, but all I can say at this point is that it's been a fun ride so far. Whether there's a product market fit, I guess time will tell. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Whitney Johnson. And you also talk about the notion of distinctive strengths, right? If we take the notion of competitive advantage that we talk about, thanks to Michael Porter and some of the frameworks around strategy, how do we think about distinctive strengths and competitive advantage as individuals? And you talk about different ways of getting to this. And more specifically, of the various things you say, I really liked one of the things you say, which is, what are the compliments that you get that you shrug off? So for the purpose of listeners, talk to us about the different ways of getting to discovering one's distinctive strengths.
Okay. All right. So distinctive strengths. So what is a distinctive strength? A distinctive strength is something that you do well that people around you don't, like the koala. So the koala, we look at the koala and they're like, oh, cuddly little animal. But the thing that we don't know is that the koala sleeps about 20 hours a day. And so now you're like, okay, well, if I slept 20 hours a day, how would I survive? Well, the koala survives because it eats eucalyptus leaves, which are poisonous to humans and pretty much every other animal on the planet. So this now becomes its distinctive strength because it doesn't have to forage for food because the food's just when the koala wants the food's there. So what does that mean then for us? Is what we want to do is we want to play where no one else is playing. So the first accelerant of personal disruption, that idea of how to grow by playing and then play to our distinctive strengths. Now, the thing about strengths that is really interesting, there are a couple of things. First of all, we don't always know what our strengths are. And you're probably thinking, well, yes, we do. Well, no, we don't know what they are because we tend to be blind to them. They're blind spots for us because they're things that we do so readily, so reflexively that we don't see them. They're just a part of who we are. We're completely blind to them. And so one of the things that I recommend you do is think about asking yourself some questions to help you ferret out what your strengths are. And one of them that you just referred to, Deepak, is... Is it Deepak or Deepak, by the way?
Deepak, actually. D-P-U-C-K, actually, if you want the pronunciation right. It's like the Canadian puck, the ice hockey puck. And Deepak is the English, Indian way of pronouncing it. But I'm used to Deepak, so no worries.
Well, I'm going to try Deepak.
Yep.
See if I can do it.
Sure.
Okay, Deepak. Okay, so because names are very important, right? We need to be called correctly. So I apologize that earlier I pronounced it incorrectly.
No worries.
Okay, so one of the things that you mentioned is this idea of what compliments do you shrug off? And so what we want to do with those compliments is frequently, if you or I get a compliment, we deflect it almost immediately. Like I have found over and over again when I'm presenting these ideas in a workshop or a keynote and I ask people what compliments, they can't tell me what they are. And it's the reason we do that is that we can't tell them is because as soon as we hear it, it's like it's Teflon. We completely shrug it off. We almost can't hear it. And then if we can hear it, because it's some people are complimenting us on something that's easy for us, we're like, well, but why don't they tell me something that I do well that I worked really hard to learn? And so one of the things that you want to do in order to know what your strengths are is when someone gives you a compliment, do that thing that you don't want to do and write it down because this is your genius. And if only when you know what your genius is, only when you know what makes you feel strong, do you know what your strengths are. And when you know what your strengths are, then you're willing to play where no one else is playing. And now you've got that second accelerant of personal disruption that allows you to grow. Now that you know where you want to grow, it allows you to know how to grow is you know what makes you feel strong and then you play where no one else is playing. So those are some starting points for you to figure out what your distinctive strengths are.
Mm-hmm. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. When I work with leaders, often a big chunk of the value add is in opening the blind spots in the way they see themselves. One of my earlier guests, Tasha Urick, a lady who's researched the topic of self-awareness quite extensively, says it quite succinctly.
Self-awareness is made up of two types of self-knowledge. The first is something we named internal self-awareness, which is essentially knowing who we are on the inside. What do we value? What are we passionate about? What are our aspirations? What are the patterns of behavior that we exhibit across situations? But equally important is something called external self-awareness. And in a nutshell, what that means is knowing how other people see us. And what was fascinating, at least to me in our research, was that we found that those two types of self-knowledge, both are required for us to really be self-aware, but they're not related to each other, which I was kind of surprised by. I always thought, you know, if somebody kind of knows who they are from the inside, of course they would do the work and find out how they were seen on the outside and vice versa. But we discovered that they are, you sort of have to think about them as independent skill sets within the self-awareness area.
Back to the point from Whitney, I found that leaders in transition often operate only on the basis of internal self-awareness, which is often a distorted picture anyway, and they don't care to invest in building external self-awareness, and often that's a lost opportunity. One of the earlier guests in the podcast, Rama Bijapurkar, an accomplished leader and an non-executive director on several high-profile boards, speaks about how she was optimizing for doing something that required depth in consumer understanding, but also something that's strategic for the business. She tried her hand at market research for a while, and then at McKinsey, before she chose to carve out her own path.
So I told you earlier about the quadrant of business understanding and customer understanding, yeah. Wanting the high on both. And because I didn't, and that was the context, in fact, in which Indra said it, because I was disappointed that McKinsey didn't have the high. Mm-hmm. And I was complaining and not doing anything about it. So that's when I went and I actually set up my practice to do that. And then I had learned at McKinsey the framework. So there's a front end of, so then I conceptualized it as a front end of strategy, which is the, what game will you play in the market? The where and how to compete as a business as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I said the back end was aligning all your functional strategies with it. Mm-hmm. So the make or buy decision is aligned with how are you best going to fulfill the promise to your customer. Mm-hmm. So it fits with choose the value, deliver the value, signal the value. So I said the front piece is mine. Mm-hmm. And that's a piece I'm going to hang on to. And in order to make sure when the downstream happens that everybody is true to the game, the market game so decided, you need to hire me in order to just be the protagonist for or the protector of the strategy that you first had. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise it gets blurred as you go down the line.
I guess the future will be a lot more about how we can create pathways that play to our distinctive strengths. Having a very clear understanding of who we are and what gives us energy will be paramount. As you know, this podcast is a labor of love and requires quite a bit of effort to identify the guests, research them, speak to them, edit the conversations, cross-reference with other earlier insights and so on. If you're deriving value from it, the only humble request I make is that you consider paying it forward to an organization that I work with, Antarang Foundation. They help children from challenging backgrounds play to their unique potential by giving them critical skills to find formal employment, building their self-awareness, and by connecting them to the world of opportunity. You can know more at playtopotential.com/paidforward. Now, let's get back to Whitney Johnson. And along the way, you talk about the notion of leaning into your constraints, right? In the initial part of the S-curve, whether it's a new role in a company or a different job or an entrepreneurial plunge, there's often significant resistance that we face. And you speak about leaning into the constraints here, and you talk about multiple dimensions, right? Money, knowledge, and time. I found this quite interesting. Talk to us about the notion of leaning in to the constraints.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's go back to our S, right? We're starting to move up that S. So you've been at the bottom, you're playing, you're feeling strong, you're playing where no one else is playing, and you're about to hit that knee of that curve where you're going to be move into hyper growth. And so there's this tendency for us to say, well, if only I had more time, or if I had more money, or I had more expertise, or if people understood my idea, then I could move into the sweet spot of that S curve. But that's actually not correct. It's not accurate. We know that it is a law of physics that we need something to bump up against in order to have enough energy to move forward, in order to gain the momentum that we want, in order to climb the curve. Let me give you just a few examples that will illustrate this idea of the importance of leaning into our constraints. Mm-hmm. So the first example is, there was a film produced by Steven Spielberg some years ago, and we all know who Steven Spielberg is. And he, the most famous scenes in that film, they came about because of constraints. So he's completely over budget. He's completely behind schedule. Everything that he wanted to use, it didn't work. The mechanical shark that he wanted to use, it didn't work. And so he finally had to shoot the scenes from the shark's point of view, and let the music and our imagination do the rest. Well, we all now know that this film that we're talking about is Jaws. And without those constraints, Jaws may very well have been a sort of B movie. It's sort of, it's good enough. But with those constraints, it's become a classic. So that's one example. The second example is more of a business example. There was a postmortem a few years ago done of about 200 failed startups. And so they divide the startups into funded startups. So the startups that had gone raised outside capital, they had investors. And then the unfunded startups, which had not been able to raise outside capital, they had to bootstrap and basically build their business with the cash that they had on hand and their operating cash flow. Well, when they did the postmortem, they discovered that the number one reason that the funded startups, the ones that had money, went out of business was that they ran out of cash. And it was only the number 10 reason for the unfunded startups. So the question then becomes, was Spielberg, were these startups successful or not successful because of or in spite of constraints? And so what I argue is that in order for us to climb a curve, we need constraints. Now, we don't need so many constraints that they crush us. Like, there's an optimal amount of constraints. But oftentimes we find that the very thing that you think you don't have enough of, whether it's money or time or expertise or buy-in, if you will reframe this as a tool of creation, then you will start to get the momentum that you need and you want to move into hypergrowth along that curve.
Mm-hmm. And one thing maybe going back, Whitney, we didn't explore explicitly is stop loss points, right? When we jump S curves, do you have anything to say about how people should think about cutting their losses in case they don't get the returns that they expect at the point of jumping from one S curve to another?
Oh, yes, that's a great question. And you asked me that earlier and I went in a different direction. Okay, so here are two things to think about around that. So whenever you jump to a brand new S curve, we know from the theory of disruption, if you're taking on market risk, the odds of success are 6 times higher, but that's 6% to 36%. So there's still, you know, a 64% chance that it's not necessarily the right S curve. So here are four questions that you can ask yourself. When you jump to a new S curve, you're not, it feels like, and you're at the low end of that S and you're like, there's no growth happening. And you don't know for sure if it's really not happening or you just can't see it yet. So four questions you can ask yourself is number one, am I playing where no one else is playing? So the first accelerant of personal disruption. Number two, am I playing to my strengths? So you might have a great idea and you might be playing where no one else is playing, but if you're trying to do something in an arena where you don't actually fundamentally have any strengths, that's going to be tough. The third question you want to ask yourself, is it hard but not debilitating? So for example, if you wake up every morning and there's like this mountain of an S curve that you're trying to scale and you say, this is hard, but I feel alive, then growth is probably on its way. But if you're feeling, if you're dreading your work, maybe even getting sick, these can be symptoms of this flatlining curve. And then the fourth question you want to ask yourself is, am I gaining momentum? You know, if last week it took, you know, 4 hours to do something, this week, does it take 2 hours? Like, are you starting to see some momentum, even though it might seem small, but is that momentum kicking in? And if your answers to those four questions are no, then it's probably a signal that you need to consider certainly tweaking what you're trying to do, but it also may be a sign that you need to jump to a brand new S curve, knowing that no S curve is ever wasted. And one favorite quote I have on this is from Seth Godin, marketing genius. And he says, winners quit all the time. They just quit the right stuff at the right time. And so those four questions can help you know. If the answers are no, it's probably time to quit. We know from research that if you don't quit when you should quit, this idea of a stop loss, our bodies actually generate this inflammatory molecule that contributes to things like heart disease and diabetes. And if we don't quit when we're on the wrong S curve, that frustration that we're feeling starts to have this contagion effect in all areas of our life. So winners quit all the time. They just quit the right stuff at the right time. If you're on that low end of that S curve, those four questions you ask, their answer is no, it's time to jump to a new curve to cut your losses. If the answers are yes, then maybe it's just more persistence is required. What we know from the math is that if it's a brand new role, it could take at least 6 months before you start to hit that knee of that S curve. And so sometimes it's just patience and persistence is required, but those four questions will help you know if it's patience required or it's time to jump to a new S curve.
Got it. Very helpful. And going back to the earlier example of this executive in LinkedIn that you spoke about, Dan Shapiro, you in the book, you talk about stepping down, stepping back, or stepping sideways to grow. And the one thing I found interesting as you explore that theme is you talk about rethinking our metrics when we do it. Say more here.
Yes. Okay. So if you think about in any situation, so if you're on, okay, let's go back to our piece of graph paper, right? And you're at 18 and you go down to 15. And Well, let's take Dan. Let's go back to Dan, as you just illustrated. So the metric for success for Dan when he was in sales, very obvious, right? Are we growing top line revenue? That's an easy one. But if you now go into product and you're building great product, can you use the same metric of success? Am I growing revenue? Well, you can, but if you do, then you're going to fail every time. It's not the right metric. The metric when you're in a brand new role is going to be totally different. In this particular instance, it was how quickly am I learning? How quickly am I iterating? How quickly can I get to the point where I can contribute and bring my insight to help the people on my team develop and build great product? And so whenever you step back or you jump to a new S curve, it's really important to rethink the metrics. That's inside of your career. And certainly for anybody who is making the decision to become an entrepreneur or making the decision to leave the workforce and retire and to go run a nonprofit. Like if you continue to use the metric of how much money am I making and you're running a nonprofit, you are going to fail every single day of your life. But that's because it's the wrong metric. And so when we're stepping back to slingshot forward, in order for us to be able to be successful, we need to make sure that we're using the right metrics to measure our progress.
And could you maybe illustrate with a couple of examples on what's the kind of shift that we need in the metrics, just for people to get a realistic sense on what the traps could be and therefore how we should, what's the language around how we rethink the metrics?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the ways that we can do this is to say to ourselves, I remember when I was writing this book, I came across a gentleman who was telling me about how he had been on one S curve and he was an executive inside of a company. And so the metrics he was using were things like, you know, are we generating revenue? Are we expanding margins? Typical things that you would look at from a P&L perspective when you're running a business. He now retires and decides to become, be a grandfather full time. Well, he's on a brand new S curve. The tendency is when we jump to a brand new S curve is to use the same metrics that we used before because it's become part of our wiring. But if this gentleman every day was waking up and saying, how much revenue have I generated today? Have I expanded margins? Because that's what he's now wired to do. That's what he's in the habit of doing. Every single morning, he was going to feel like he was ineffective. The metric had to shift to, how present am I for my grandchildren today? Did I take them to the park? Did they discover something that made them feel full of wonder and curiosity? Was I able to be present during that time? I'll give you an even simpler example because I think this is to drill down on this idea. I have a checklist every day that I use, sort of 10 things that I want to accomplish every day. So, I want to run today. I'm going to read some type of spiritual sacred text. I have a list of 4 things I'm going to accomplish. I'm going to, things that I'm going to do every day. Well, one of the things I discovered is that that is a great checklist for me Monday through Saturday. But Sunday, I want it to be a day of rest. I want it to be a day of worship. And one of the things that I was finding that was very frustrating for me is that I was carrying over my checklist from Monday through Saturday to Sunday. So I was getting really frustrated because I was thinking, well, I'm measuring myself by this checklist that I'm using the other 6 days. And so what I had to start doing was create a new checklist for Sunday. You know, things like, did I go to church today? Did I spend time with my family? Did I do family history? Did I write in my journal? Totally different checklist. And so that's what I mean is when you look at the S curve that you've decided to jump to, whether it's in your personal or your professional life, the metrics you use, make sure that that is measuring what you want to measure so that you'll know if in fact you're successful and not measuring yourself against metrics that actually aren't relevant and just lead to frustration and a feeling that you're on the wrong S curve. So one quick quote around that I love, and I think this is important. It's from Liz Strauss. She says, it's not possible for the world to hold a meeting to decide your value. That decision is yours. And that's where these idea of metrics come in. You have to decide what metrics you're going to use to decide your value.
That's profound, profound. In the sense, your organization might evaluate you on certain terms, which is their terms. You need to evaluate yourself on your terms. And that's the point you're making, I guess.
Yep, absolutely. And I would take that one step further, Deepak, is this idea of if the way that they're measuring you doesn't match to how you measure yourself, then you've got to figure out what you're going to adjust.
Mm-hmm. Well, that reminds me of my conversation with Professor Stuart Friedman of Wharton, who talks about work life, and he talks about exactly this, which is, you know, he talks about self, work, home, and community. And he says, if there's a disconnect between where you're spending time and where you want to spend time, then maybe it's something for you to reflect on and make choices consistent with what's important to you. So that's a lovely quote from Liz Strauss. That brings me to another theme that we explore in the podcast, Whitney. I had Professor Herminia Ibarra from London Business School talk about this notion of identity and working identity. And you talk about it in the book as well. You talk about the fact that we often attach labels to ourselves based on the roles we play or the job we do. And if we sort of adopt the Tarzan model, if you will, of jumping multiple S-curves, how should people think about their identity, especially during this phase of transition when you're moving between two curves?
Such a great question. Yeah. So I love that. So this idea of Tarzan, I remember a couple of years ago, I was talking to Saul Kaplan at the Business Innovation Factory. And he said, you know, my life has been about jumping from one S curve to the next, swinging like Tarzan from one S curve to the next, because that's where I do my best work, when I'm always in that sweet spot of that S curve. But as you pointed out, when you're at this top of an S curve and you make that decision to jump, there's this moment of free fall, this loss of identity, the PE, because I'm financial terms, PE, but puke to excitement ratio can get so uncomfortably high that you basically feel like you're on this thrill ride to zero. And so what do you do about that? And I think the first thing is just to be aware that it's there. Whenever you're stepping back from who you are into who you can be, there is that moment of free fall, and it's normal and it's natural. I think the way that we allow ourselves to do that or to manage that is to say, okay, well, I'm jumping from this S curve to this S curve. And you think of these little baby S's, right? But then because our life and our career, there's this fractal of S curves. If you can think of it as I'm on this little mini S curve that I'm jumping to a new one, but that's on a much bigger S curve, which then goes to your purpose and your why and who you are and your fundamental sense of who you are, then it becomes a lot easier to do. A quick example that I think will help here is I remember when, as I said earlier, when I was in investment banking and then they moved me, polite term, into equity research, I remember having this moment of, they said, well, here's what we want you to do. Like, they didn't force me to do it. I got to make the decision, but this is what they want you to do. And I remember having this experience of evaluating it and saying, okay, so does this make sense for me to do? And you know, should I do this? And I had this, I still remember where I was sitting. I was sitting in our apartment on 71st Street in Manhattan. We had this newborn baby. I think he was like 4 months old at this time. And I remember thinking, this is a good decision. Like, I could feel it. It was a good decision for me to do this, that somehow, some way, this step back was going to be a slingshot forward, which goes to our broader purpose in life, right? What's our why? What are we trying to get done in our life? And when we can think about, what am I trying to get done in my life? That allows us to have a sense of what our identity is. And so then these smaller S-curve jumps are just within the broader context of the identity of who we are. And that allows us to hold that. And so that free fall, instead of feeling like it's, you know, a jump of 100 feet down that S curve, there's a safety net of, it's a jump of 2 or 3 feet, because we know that within our broader identity, our broader sense of self, it's not quite so big of a jump as it feels right in that moment.
I guess at some level, it sounds a bit like having some clarity around the why, not just jumping for the sake of jumping, but having a clear sense for why it fits in to your overall life context.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, Deepak. I mean, if you think about it, again, back to this graph paper, none of us would ever go from 18 to 15 unless we believe that there is a slingshot forward. And so when you're doing that calculus, you are saying to yourself, I mean, it's just like a business, right? You invest in PP&E, you invest in product, plant, and equipment because you believe that that equipment, that plant will allow you to build something for the future. And it's exactly the same for us as an individual. We part with something today. Business, it's cash. We start with prestige. We start with status. We part with status or standing or prestige today because we believe that we are investing in a future which we can envision for ourselves, which, as you say, goes back to our why or our purpose and why we believe we're on this planet.
And maybe just contextualizing it to real life, Whitney, do you have a view on how this curve looks like for people across industries? I'm curious about the momentum of the curve in terms of how quickly, you know, the life cycle of the S-curve, if you will. Do you see a significant shift across industries? Is there any pattern that you want us to observe or be aware of in terms of how this plays out in different contexts?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what we found is that the typical duration of an S curve is about 4 years. If you're working, you know, 40 hours a week and you're mapping against that 10,000 hour rule. So, you know, you're going to be at the low end of your S curve, or sometimes we call it the launch point of that S curve, for 6 months to a year. And then you're going to be in the sweet spot of your S curve for 2 to 3 years. And then at the high end of that S curve for 6 months to a year, before it's time for you to either jump or find some sort of stretch assignment that pushes you back down into the sweet spot so you can elongate out that curve. But to your question, are there, you know, is it different across industries or across disciplines? And the answer is absolutely yes. I remember when I had drafted this book, I sent it off to a friend of mine who is a rocket scientist. I mean, he has a degree from Stanford in aerospace engineering, and he read this and he said, okay, we've got a problem here because I have studied this. I'm an aerospace engineer. I think this is also going to be true for surgery, where you may never get to the high end of the S curve, and it is definitely going to take you longer than 6 months or a year to get into the sweet spot of that S curve. And so what we do find is that with certain disciplines, that the bottom of that S curve is going to be much, much, much longer and flatter for a longer time. And then before you move into the sweet spot of that S curve. So it does vary by certainly not so much industry, but definitely by discipline.
And overall, in terms of guidance for people as they think about their careers, you talk about the notion of discovery-driven career planning, right? And I liked your quote of the Times columnist David Brooks, where he says, most people don't form a self and then lead a life. They are called by a problem, and the self is constructed gradually by their calling. And you go on to say that you actually discover your calling one baby step at a time. So as we sort of wind down the podcast, what's your sense of, or what's your advice for people to think about their careers in the context of these multiple S-curves and the multiple disruptions that are happening in business and in people's lives?
So I have a couple of thoughts there. First of all, one of the things that we've seen in the research is that 70% of all successful businesses end up in a different place than they expected. So the strategy that they use to become successful is very different than the strategy that they started with. And I think there's an analog for us in our careers and in our lives is we can start out when we're 21 years old, 22 years old, having this plan. But as we end up becoming successful and using this quote from David Brooks, we don't know what that's going to look like. And so we just start taking one step forward, we gather feedback and we adapt. And over time, we will construct that life for ourselves. And we will very likely be successful if we will put one step in front of the other. But what that's going to look like, we just do not know. One piece of advice I have around that, and I think, is that whenever you're taking that step forward, sometimes there are three different options. And especially for people early in your career, you don't know what you want to do. We have two children. We have a 23-year-old. We have a 19-year-old. They don't know what they want to do yet. That is completely normal. And even I think when people are 30 and 40 and 50, they don't know what they want to do. And so when you're in that moment where you don't know, what I have found the best thing to do is to say, okay, I've got three options in front of me. I don't know which one is the best option. So what I say to myself is, okay, okay, if I go in option A, on the other side of option A, once I get to the top of that S-curve and it's time for me to jump to a new S-curve, how many S-curves will there be available to me? How many doors will be available to me? Is it 2? Is it 4? Is it 20? Option number 2, is it 5? Is it 10? Is it 15? Is it 100? And option number 3, is it 1,000? And what you want to do when you don't know is take whichever S-curve will give you the most S-curves on the other side so that you can give yourself as much optionality as possible. Certainly that is important early in your career. And then I guess the last thing in building on this, David Brooks, is just be engaged, be fully in the sweet spot of your life every day. And then you're going to start to find these problems that you think, I need to solve this problem. And then as you're solving that problem, you will realize, oh, I've constructed a life. It will surprise you. And in many instances, it will delight you.
That's a wonderful place to finish this conversation, Whitney. Be engaged. I love that. And thank you so much for sharing your insights on the Play to Potential podcast.
Deepak, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
In addition to the point around keeping options open, I do think that in a world of abundant choices and divergent pathways, there's something to be said about the criticality of self-awareness. Here's Rama Bijapurkar, a board member, talking about this.
You know, one of the young men actually I know said to me, he must have been, he was a student of mine from Ahmedabad, and I said to him that you're very lucky because you can do whatever you want, whereas my generation was told that if you made your bed, sleep in it. So my brother went to IIT for 2 years, hated it, was told to finish it, and then he went to the Indian Army after that on a permanent commission. So he said, ma'am, but you don't understand my anxiety. He said, my father's told me you can do anything you ever want to do. And he said, I'm always looking around the corner to see if there's something better. And I absolutely what you're saying, the fear of missing out. But I think the more there are choices, the more you have to be centered. The world is complex and volatile. And I think the more complex and volatile it is, the more you have to understand your center and your core. You know, going back to the earlier discussion we were having, you have to really, really understand. So if you are anchored, then you can withstand being buffeted. It's the same for companies too, right? I tell companies that if you're going to do competitor busting, and whatever the competitor came up with, you're going to re-engineer it, reverse engineer it and do better. When you have 20 competitors who are putting out 20 products because they also don't know all ready, fire, aim, then are you going to bust 400? How do you know which 20 of the 400 to bust?
It's noise, yeah.
Yeah, so you eventually have to have a deep understanding of who you are and what you're trying to do with your customers and take it from there. So if you don't have that who you are understanding, or at least your navigational principles, I'm willing to sacrifice money for glory, or listen, I want a certain amount of balance in my life. And I think you then figure out, even if the answer is that I have to do these things because I have to do them, though I believe something else, I'm saying as long as you know that's what it is, you'll be able to deal with it better. But knowledge is an absolute master of what is inside of you.
Yeah, very true. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. Thank you for your time and attention. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. To access the archives that have been curated by specific themes, please visit playtopotential.com. If you're deriving value from the podcast, a couple of requests. Do consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation. You can find the details at playtopotential.com/payitforward. And do take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. It'll help others discover the content, and it'll also help us attract higher quality speakers as we move forward. And if you want to know more about the advisory work I do, please visit playtopotential.com and go to the section about the host. Thank you for listening, and bye now.